All right, hello everyone. I am finally back. I want to apologize about last week. I had an English paper due in my English class. It was a final draft, so I didn't really have time to do the episode. I had to write the essay out. And then this week, as you know from my blog post, I had to take two midterms. I finished the math one today, and that was the last one. I thought I had one late in the evening. I had kind of mixed up when physics and math were, so I can do the podcast. I'm doing it Tuesday instead of Wednesday, which I said I would do it. As a quick aside before I get onto the topic of the episode, which is mainly answering everyone's questions that they gave me in an email, I wanted to, as a quick aside, talk about the Nightline debate and want to know if anyone had seen the Nightline Kirk Cameron Ray Comfort versus the Rational Response Squad debate, and the clips of this debate are available on Nightline's website. I bring it up because Kirk Cameron and Ray Comfort did, I guess, an excellent job of portraying evolution in a horrible light. For instance, Kirk Cameron, when he was discussing evolution, said, evolutionists believe there was nothing, then there was an explosion, and then there was something or everything. And this is a common misconception of what evolution actually is. It's as if creationists took evolution and then the Big Bang and then a bunch of other scientific theories that talk about the evolution as in change of a certain thing, for instance, from non-life to life, or from the universe's singularity to the whole universe as we see it now. Scientists use evolution as a term for change, and when they discuss the Big Bang or biogenesis, they mention that word. And what Kirk Cameron does here is he says, well, they mention evolution, so it must be related to evolutionary theory, which is a totally different subject, as we all know. But it's as if they take a biogenesis, the Big Bang, evolution, and clump them all together into one big theory, and then attack certain aspects of the Big Bang and a biogenesis that maybe aren't as well-defined or well-evidenced as various aspects in evolutionary theory. And by clumping it all together, they create a straw man that's pretty easy to knock down sometimes. And then again, Kirk Cameron also brought up some very bizarre things that kind of just destroy any chance of credibility that he might have had elsewhere in the debate. For instance, he took a graphic artist, he had his graphic artist kind of design these creatures, which he said evolution predicted. Of course, in no way does evolution actually predict these things. It was like he took a duck and a crocodile, for instance, and he took the upper part of the crocodile and the lower part of the duck and kind of wedged them together and said this is what evolution predicts as a intermediary form between crocodiles and ducks. Just a bunch of other bizarre things that totally destroy any attempt of his credibility. But it was interesting because this is the first actual debate they've had of an atheist and a Christian versus about the existence of God. But the main reason I bring it up is because it was discussing the whole evolution issue, which Kirk Cameron and Ray Comfort were bringing up as kind of a thing for many people don't believe in God due to evolution is what their claim was. Of course, this could be true and this could not. I think it's because of this dichotomy that these people create that it's either God or evolution that leads to many people not accepting evolution or not accepting God. If they were to allow kind of bridge to be there, this is what theistic evolution pretty much is, then we wouldn't have so much of an issue. So I just wanted to bring up that little Nightline debate because it kind of tied into what I'm talking about on the show. So moving on to the main topic, I got a lot of questions over the past 2 weeks, and I'm going to try to answer most of them. There's one of them that I'm going to try to leave for a later episode because it does seem to have the potential to be something more than just a little brief response I give about a question. So I received two audio questions, so I'll post the audio first and then discuss the questions. I got another question from Lenny, which I'm going to discuss, and then another one from a listener known as Catherine. And then I also got an email from an old listener, I remember him from before, and he gave me quite a few questions, so I'll answer those after I address the two audio questions.
Okay. All right, Robert. I guess I'm going to try and ask a couple of questions. Excuse the sound quality, I have a really crappy mic. Hopefully, they're as eloquent as Lenny's. And, oh, by the way, this is Catherine, the person that's always spamming the forum. Okay, my first question is, how many subscribers do you have? I didn't see that in your iTunes profile, so I guess I was just wondering about that. Okay, my second question It's a little bit less simple than the last one. With regard to your continued comments concerning religion versus science, and as well faith versus reason. Of course, religion being depicted as faith without reason, and of course science as alternatively reason without faith. So, I guess I'm wondering, and you're welcome to add this to your creationist segment of the day, I'm wondering how you would respond to the notion that, unquote, science can't explain everything. So, of course, you'll encounter people that will point out that science cannot account for a lot of things in the universe, such as science can't explain why babies cry, or why potato chips taste good, or why we exist, or what is the meaning, purpose of our existence, etc., etc., etc. So you'll encounter this, and so people will conclude things like, well, if science can't account for such simple things like this, such as why we exist, then what makes science any more valid than religion? So I guess I'm sort of hitting a relativist sort of argument, and I understand that this is sort of a loaded question, but I'm just wondering how you would respond to something or someone like that. All right, thank you for listening. Bye.
All right, first of all, I'd like to thank you for the question, Catherine. To begin with, you can see my subscriber count on the bottom of my blog page, so that's where you can find it. As for your main question as to the relativist position between science and religion, science doesn't really have all the answers. It does, however, have the answers to a lot of the things you brought up. Science can explain why babies cry. There's no mathematical formula describing, you know, baby crying per unit time, but nonetheless, we know why it happens scientifically. And the same thing is with the taste of the potato chip. Now, in regards to existence, science can explain how it is that we came to exist through evolution, hominid evolution. We were the result of hominid evolution, or one of the results, I should say. But as for a why, science doesn't really touch on that issue. First of all, we can't really say there is a why we exist. For instance, my personal view is that there is no all-knowing why of why we exist, but that this purpose to our existence is given to us by our own selves. We derive a purpose for our existence. So, first of all, who says there has to be a why? And second of all, does it have to come from a supernatural source? Are two questions you want to ask yourself. Science can answer the how, religion goes for the why. The reason why religion can't be compared to science is because, first of all, they deal with two different areas of interest. Science is the how, religion is the why. Now second, and this is why I think you can't really take a relativist position between religion and science, is that religion deals with the unfalsifiable. Nothing in religion, except for the historical aspect of it, no real theological claims in it can be tested. However, explanations by science can. When we deal with the real world based on observation, science is much more valid because I can present evidence for it that is a logical result of the theory that I'm adhering to. However, if someone's going to say animals are the way they are because God made them that way, which is what Kirk Cameron used in his debate that I was referring to earlier, that's a totally unfalsifiable position. Not to say that people can't believe this, but that it's not a scientific explanation. You can't just say things are the way they are because God made them, because God could have made them any sort of way that you see them. So no matter how they look, well, God made them that way. Now, I've mentioned this time and time again. Sure, people can have both religion and science. That's no problem. But they deal with two different realms of interest. Religion can't tackle that how of things. When they try to, in the form of young earth creationism, we see that it really cannot deal with how, because it always relies on God, and God is unfalsifiable. Now, if we're to assume a why for our existence, science doesn't tell us why we are here. It just tells us that we can verify things via testing. So we can test the real world with science. We can make claims about morality and other issues, not the how of morality, but why things are moral and etc., through things that aren't really testable because they're really abstract notions that don't exist in the physical realm. So to answer your question, people who decide to take up a relativist position between science and religion, they're two totally different issues. I mean, you can't really take this notion of God and apply it to the how of things. So I can't say babies cry because of God, but science can explain this other stuff. God has to stay out of the realm of making claims about the physical world, the physical reality we live in. And Science, likewise, can't really explain why we are here, etc., those kind of things. So the relativist position has to be religion answers the why, science answers the how, and you leave those two separate. So that's what I think should happen. Now, next, we had Lenny gave me another question. It was in regards to global warming, and I was debating whether or not to talk about this one on the show, but in the end, I decided to, because it does provide a good example of how to critically think about these quote-unquote controversial issues. And so I'm going to let you listen to that question, and then I'm going to respond to it.
Hello, Robert. This is Lenny again. Thank you for very competently answering my question last time. It helped out a lot. I've got another one, and it relates to something at my school or college that we went over in my biology class, global warming. This seems to be one of those those issues that, like evolution, is pretty complicated, and so I'm in the state that I don't know what to believe on it. I don't know enough about it, and so I was hoping you could shed some light on this. We watched Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth in the class, and, I mean, it seemed like the data was pretty rock hard, but I just don't have the time to look into every single little fact and figure that he cites. But later we got to do presentations in the class on whatever subject we wanted, and some people did a refutation of it, so I was hoping you'd just shed some light on that. Thank you.
All right, so briefly, my view on global warming is that, yes, global warming is definitely happening. The evidence points to, yes, it is occurring, and that mankind has definitely contributed to it. But the point I want to make about these kind of things is that doing the research and knowing what sources to use and checking your work is always the most important thing when dealing with these controversial issues. Al Gore's movie is a decent resource, but by far not the best one, and I would suggest not using it as your only source in a discussion with people who, say, deny that global warming occurs. Because, first of all, they're going to look at the political issue and say, you know, Al Gore is a politician and he's trying to just get his way and he's not a very good source for information. However, what you can do from Al Gore's movie is look at the sources that he used and go check on those and see if they're more scholarly and check out the scholarly stuff to see if the information is there. I would suggest if you're going to look at the global warming issue to check out the IPCC report. It's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and they come out with reports every so often that deal with global warming. And if you're gonna, I wouldn't recommend reading the whole thing because it's very, very long, but they have a summary for policymakers in the beginning, which is the short and sweet version. Their work is peer-reviewed writing, and their work is based on peer-reviewed writing and other scientific literature. It has much more credibility in the eyes of most people than Al Gore's movie does. So I deal with scholarly and scientific articles when dealing with science issues. Deal with the very beginning, the very foundational writings that deal with these issues, the very scholarly ones. I had to deal with Lyndon LaRouche's youth movement on my campus about global warming not too long ago. They're kind of like the Kent Hovinds, Kirk Camerons, and Ray Comforts of global warming. My main point is, again, study the issue, think critically about it, and those who oppose it, and see which side makes a stronger argument. For instance, with evolution, we take a look at what creationists have to say and what evolutionary scientists have to say, and realize that, well, evolution has the science for it, and that young earth creationism is nothing more than just a religious view, and that it cannot be science by basic definition of what young earth creationism actually is. So, I've informed you of my personal view, but again, check it out for yourself, and just see which side has the most evidence going for it. Now, lastly, I got a few questions from a fellow by the name of Hans. Now, there's no audio clip, as I mentioned before, but the questions are really good ones that all deal with the Big Bang or quantum physics. So I decided, since that's my area of expertise and what the show is supposed to be about, really, that I decide to entertain them. First, Hans asks about vacuum fluctuations and how causality is affected by them. For those of you who are new to the show or just simply forget what vacuum fluctuations are, They are spontaneously produced particle pairs in the vacuum of space, and all these, the sum of these virtual vacuum particles form what's known as the quantum foam. When we view empty space in relativity, what we see is basically flatness. There's no jitters to the emptiness of space, which is what would seem to make sense. But when we get onto the realm of the very microscopic, when we zoom in, for instance, on a very tiny region of space over and over again until we get just down to the very basics of what space actually is, we find that space isn't the calm, placid thing that relativity says it is. In fact, what we find is that there are all these jitters, that space is actually bouncing up and down pretty much in its energy and energy relation over time. And this is due to the uncertainty principle. We cannot tell at any specific point. There's always an uncertainty at these specific points as to energy level and position and momentum of particles. So when we get down to that very basic understanding, our very basic understanding of quantum mechanics tells us that space-time cannot be as flat as we see. However, when we get further away, what we see, these jitters kind of get calmed down, and relativity kind of sorts these things out. Now, of course, these two views aren't totally reconcilable, and that's why we have to get a quantum theory of gravity to kind of make sense of these two totally different views. But what you can kind of imagine it as is that as we zoom out from this quantum jitteriness, this jumping around, what we get is a calmer view as we overlook the entire area. So it kind of neutralizes and becomes the general relativity view that we know and love. So going back to the questions about how vacuum fluctuations affect causality, these vacuum fluctuations need to have enough energy in order to exist in certain regions of space. However, I want to note that the energy does not cause the fluctuation. It's only a requirement for the fluctuation to exist. So just because the energy is there doesn't mean that it's going to suddenly cause a fluctuation to occur. But if the energy is present, then a fluctuation can occur. Likewise, gas is required for a car to run, but it doesn't cause the car to run. There are other things that are needed. However, there does not appear right now to be any sort of cause for a vacuum fluctuation. A pair of particles are created and annihilated within a very brief amount of time, but that seems to be it. There's nothing that triggers these vacuum fluctuations. They seem to be inherently random. So in terms of causality, vacuum fluctuations seem to exist without a cause. To be fair now, on the scales we're dealing with, not a whole lot is known about the nature of space and time, and again, we're constantly correcting what our views are as we're trying to develop this notion of quantum gravity and unify quantum mechanics and general relativity. So our views obviously could change, but it is known that vacuum fluctuations do occur in nature, so these vacuum fluctuations, just because they're occurring on a very tiny scale, we know that these vacuum fluctuations actually are occurring. They're not just something we make up. And this is verified by testing the Casimir effect, where we see two parallel plates attracted to one another in a vacuum because there are more virtual particles pushing on it from the outside than there are on the inside. So there's some force that kind of pushes these plates ever so slightly together, and that's how we can tell that these vacuum fluctuations are occurring within the vacuum of space. But this was a very good question, and I remember when I actually went to see and talk to Hugh Ross, the old Earth creationist, because he came in a nearby town, I went to go see that, I actually brought up the notion of vacuum fluctuations to him and how it did affect causality. So way back when, I did see it as a major problem for this notion that everything in the universe has to have a cause, and that cause would therefore be God. And he didn't really answer my point. He kind of had to explain to the audience what vacuum fluctuations were, and I think that it's also a good idea to explain to people what these things are that I'm trying to discuss, but he ended up kind of avoiding the consequence of what my statement was. So, again, this is a very good question. Now, your next question was, do cosmologists have any idea of how much force the light and radiation causes to push the galaxies and stars apart? There should be some kind of force from the fact that every star is expelling energy in all directions and basically causes them to separate, kind of pushing each other away. So your question's in regards to stars themselves and the light radiation they emit, and if that causes some kind of pushing out force. Well, actually, the light emitted from stars is radiation, and stars emit electromagnetic radiation all the time. EM radiation is in the form of photons, which are massless particles. Now, from Newton's equations, the force of a photon is zero because it has no mass, and according to Newton, force equals mass multiplied by acceleration. It may provide energy to massive particles because photons can be captured by atoms and the energy within a photon can be used and transformed into something else, which can then be used to do some sort of useful work. But there's actually no real repulsive force emitted from stars towards one another. In fact, gravity is in effect the only force exerted by stars on other stars, but we all know that's an attractive force. So stars don't really exert any kind of repulsive force. Next, you had a question about why inflation died off after a few brief milliseconds, and now the universe seems to be speeding up in its expansion yet again. So why is there this interlude between the quick expansion due to inflation, and then kind of pause, wait, and then all of a sudden this new acceleration picks up, this expansion starts kicking up again? So what's this interlude? First of all, we got to ask ourselves, is this due to the same phenomena? Is inflation occurring suddenly again, or are we dealing with something totally new? And the question is, we're dealing with two different sort of things, inflation being one, and this new acceleration being a totally different thing. So why did inflation stop, and then things got going again later? And why wasn't the force that's causing the acceleration now causing the accelerated expansion before? Now this is a really good question. I mean, if there's something causing the universe to expand now, why didn't it cause things to expand in the past? And similarly, why is inflation not kicking in anymore? What happened to it? Why did it stop? So inflation caused the expansion in the very early universe. And nowadays, we think what is causing the universe to expand is dark energy. Although, again, you'll talk to various physicists and some of them will say, yes, that's a good idea, or no, this idea is totally fruitless and there's no point in looking at this dark energy. First, let's look at why inflation died off. Inflation died off because the inflaton field reached its true vacuum state from some higher unstable state. So what does that mean? Well, the inflaton field is a scalar field behind the inflation. It's kind of like the electric field, which is behind the whole notion of current and all of our notions of electromagnetism, this notion of a field. In fact, it might be even better to think of it like a gravitational field. Gravity is due to the gravitational field. Inflation is due to the inflaton field. Of course, the inflaton field is different and more complex, but it might be useful to think of it in these sort of ways, that inflation is due to inflaton fields, like gravity is due to a gravitational field, and due to mass, in essence. Now, when I say it reached its true vacuum state from a higher unstable state, upon reaching this true state, it got into its lowest possible energy state, and when it has its lowest possible energy state, it can't get out of it. It can't do any more work. So inflation stopped simply because the field that produced it simply ran out of energy. There was no more energy for inflation to occur, and so inflation had to stop. And the inflaton field actually ran out very quickly, because we know inflation lasted only for the most minutest aspect of a second. It stopped very quickly. So the inflaton field ran out of energy, and inflation stopped. That was the first kind of big acceleration of our universe, the big expansion of our universe out into all sorts of places. Now, as for the expansion that's occurring today, it's still obviously a hot topic in cosmology. We don't really know all the details, and it's going to be probably a long time before we actually do know what's causing this new expansion, the nature of non-baryonic dark matter, all these sorts of things. In fact, even if it is dark energy, which is behind the expansion of this universe, right now we kind of just say, well, there has to be some kind of repulsive force to match up with what our assumptions of expansion would be. We're not totally making things up, but we know something has to be there, but we don't really know what it is. Now, the accelerated expansion due to dark energy, though, despite the fact that we just picked it up recently, is said to have begun a while back, and not just recently. How far back? No one's really sure, but we do know that it didn't just all of a sudden kick in 1999 or so when we discovered that the universe was actually accelerating in its expansion. When our techniques improved for observing the heavens, we looked at type 1a supernovae to detect the expansion rate, in fact to see how much it was slowing down by, and kind of to our surprise and to our puzzlement, we found that it was actually accelerating. So as for the expansion now, we don't really know what's behind it. We do know that we are accelerating in our expansion, but we don't know what's causing it. Inflation, however, is a totally different issue, and the reason it stopped is, as I said before, the inflaton field just ran out of energy, and so inflation didn't have anything going for it. It couldn't expand. So, I mean, it couldn't keep going. So inflation had to stop. And then at some point, this new thing, dark energy, perhaps, or whatever is causing the acceleration of our universe, began to kick in. As for exactly when it kicked in or what exactly it is, again, hopefully in the next few years or few decades, we'll find out what exactly that is. I'm of the opinion that hopefully we'll find it within the next 10 years. But again, I'm very optimistic and expect maybe a little too much out of what people are able to do with today's technology. Lastly, you had a question that was about quantum mechanics and its relationship to the notion of free will and how free will would be affected by this notion of things are kind of random in quantum mechanics. And that alone, I think, could be a discussion for a podcast. So I think I might just return on that in another podcast. It's sufficient to say, though, I think, that quantum mechanics isn't totally random in essence. It's probabilistic. And they're kind of the same thing, but we can predict how often something will occur in quantum mechanics, or in a lot of quantum mechanics. Again, returning to vacuum fluctuations, who knows what's behind that? We just can predict the probability of a vacuum fluctuation occurring. So we have the ability to predict how often these things will occur, or how often, every so often, these things will appear. But as for free will, we're not really choosing which of these options we want to go with in quantum mechanics. There's a set, say, function that's describing the probability of these certain things appearing. So in terms of free will, we're not really choosing our own path. It's just, we look at this probability function, we say this one's more likely than the other one to occur, and so it probably will occur. We're not choosing, it's just the randomness, you know, it's a roll of the dice pretty much. There's no choice involved, it's simply roll, here's what we get, here's what we do. So that's briefly what I could say in terms of free will and how quantum mechanics affects it. But again, I might return on this in a later episode. It's kind of a touchy issue because it deals with free will. However, if I get the chance later on, I will go over it and discuss how quantum mechanics would touch on free will and how it maybe conflicts with determinism and that view. Again, this topic alone could be a discussion for an entire podcast, but since I'm out of time, I'm going to leave it on this dark matter note and briefly what I talked about in terms of quantum mechanics. So before I say what we're going to do next week, I wanted to just say I don't have any specific plan for next week. I'm going to kind of just leave that out and just have what I have when I do. So I guess until then, I'll be able to come up with an episode on this coming weekend, so kind of make up for the fact that I was late this time and get back on my schedule. I don't have any more midterms coming up, so that's good, and I have a paper coming up, but it's not a final one, so I shouldn't have any kind of things holding me back from coming out with this week's podcast. So until then, I hope everyone enjoys the rest of this week. I don't know about you, but it's been really sunny where I'm at, and the weather's just been great. So I hope by where everyone else is that the weather is also great. And if it isn't, well, hopefully it gets better. So enjoy the rest of this week, and we will talk next time.